21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. These are the fundamental truths upon which our nation was founded, and they are illustrated by the new exhibit at the world-renowned American Visionary Arts Museum on Key Highway in Baltimore. Dare I say it, it's their best ever. Get over there the next free weekend you have and take all of your out-of-town visitors to AVAM to show it off. While there, do me a favor and stop by their incredible gift shop called Sideshow and buy one of my books that are on special sale at Sideshow in honor of their Life, Liberty, and Pursuit of Happiness exhibit. Call 443-872-4926. That's 443-872-4926 or on the web at avam.org. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. This is Dr. Bob Hieronymus, and you're listening to Telesma. This is Ascension by Telesma. They'll be joining us at the bottom of this hour. Of course, my executive producer and research assistant, Laura Kortner, and our engineer is Jake Bryant. We're talking with Charles Westbrook, Jr., The Kabbalion Key. It's a novel published by Cathedral Press, and his website is kabbalionkey.com. It's linked on the front page of 21st Century Radio, so I won't have to keep spelling it, because sometimes I'm going to spell it wrong, and that's going to really mess you up. You know, you don't want me to do that to you, do you? No, I don't even want to do it, but I do it anyway. Rules and Regulations 506 of the Penal Code. Charles, how does the Kabbalion Key cover constitutional questions associated with the Freedom of Religion Clause in the First Amendment?
Well, the way that it's told in the book, that there's a scene that takes place at Devil's Tower in Wyoming, and at that park, it's a national park, the first national park in America, there is a history of the Lakota wanting to carry out their Sundance ceremony at the base of Devil's Tower, and climbers who want to climb at the same time of the year. And so there's a whole legal precedence about who can do what and how it relates to the First Amendment associated with that spot. And if you understand, that's presented in one of the scenes in the novel, and if you understand that and the precedence that's presented, why that has to be the way it is, later on when you just start to discover some of the things that are in the landscape of Washington, or what the novel proposes is in the landscape of Washington, well, then you have to begin wonder, is this religious? If it is religious, you know, where is the separation of church and state?
Where is it, yeah. That's a threat that I'm always concerned about, the separation of church and state. Thank heavens for Thomas Jefferson, and what he has accomplished for Virginia, and then he accomplished for this country. And it's, but the Devil's Tower, you point out, is a volcano?
That's right.
And
the remains of a volcano.
The remains of a volcano. And does it have any magnetic qualities?
It may. I'm not aware of that, but it's hard for me to think it might not.
Because there's a lot of interesting research dealing with magnetic qualities and magnetites and what types of things that can happen in other dimensions and other dimensionality. Now,
right.
The future global brain, you cover this also in the Kabbalion Key.
Okay. What do you want me to get at there? Now?
Well,
you're talking about in relation to the internet.
Yes, of course, in the internet.
Right. Now,
but you know, the internet is extremely important to this particular book because of what the bad guys are trying to do with it.
That's right. Well, the whole theme is that the internet's going to be shut down because there's a virus, and the computer hacker has to solve that. So there's another scene in the book where there's a professor at Georgetown, and he's giving a lecture, and he's telling everyone about the importance of the new global society and how the information age is going to be the future age for our world, and how commodities will be based on the sale of transmitting and sale of information. And he's describing the internet, the global consciousness. It's been given that name by many people, and that's your global brain, mm-hmm. and we've got it today.
Well, also, again, here's a whole area that unfortunately most individuals, except for my dear friend David Overson at times, covers and talks a little bit about. That is the design element of Washington, D.C. as connected to northern constellation, as a matter of fact, connected and whose design mirrors some of the northern constellations. Have you ever heard, I'm certain you've heard of it, and I may not be using the right term for it, but when I was introduced to this about 40 or 50 years ago, it was called, well, this one perspective was called urinology or urinology. Does that ring a bell to you?
No, it doesn't.
That if you lined up certain constellations with the Great Pyramid and other locations, that certain constellations would fall over the rest of the world, and those constellations would be found in the symbols of their heraldry, and et cetera, et cetera?
Well, that makes sense to a certain degree. I can't say that's a false statement or it's a loony idea, but it makes sense, yeah.
How is the design element of D.C. connected? And
the way I present Washington, and I did this in the Talisman of the United States. The initial claim is that Washington, the diagonal street pattern of Washington, are the angles that are used for measuring from the center of a terrestrial sphere, on a military sphere, the positioning of the sun and the moon around the Earth, and these angles have been transferred into the street pattern as a type of planisphere. And there are certain angles, certain diagonal streets that point north, and they set the bounds of certain constellations in the northern sky. And there are streets that set the bounds for the sun and the moon east and west. And I carry that over into the Kabbalion Key. You're creating a representation of the order of the cosmos on the ground.
As above, so below.
That's right. That's
that
the
principle.
Of that. Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
What constellations, those northern constellations in particular, would we be looking for?
The main ones are the ones that are always there. And these would be the Dipper and the Little Dipper primarily, and, of course, Draconis.
Yeah, that's right. Now, in regards to geography and the New Earth sciences, your book discusses the idea that the Earth has a crystal core and that life emerged from Earth and Earth's harmonic. Could you go into some detail about this, please?
Yeah, this is a theory, and actually, some of the stuff is on the Discovery Channel, and you see it on commercials by oil companies all of a sudden where they're telling you, hey, we can do deep seismic graphs of the Earth, and we now know where the oil's going to be. And all this has to do with a theory that the iron core of the Earth is actually a crystal, and that this crystal is growing, and that crystal, because it is a crystal, and this pressure on the crystal has a piezo effect, and it generates a type of harmonic hum. And all of this evolves into some of the work of
Tesla,
associated with the Earth having a hum and can carry a harmonic and all that.
Well, I'm just so delighted to see all of these most unusual, almost heretical theories, which to me aren't too strange, because I've been looking at some of these things for almost a half a century, since I was about 18. I remember some of these things. There's also the God particle. What is the God particle and its relationship with the nature of light, photons?
You can take light and light that is a wave and it's also a particle, and because of that it has this strange ability to bend around objects, or at least appear that it does.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a, this gets into quantum physics, and so they're trying to understand, this goes to CERN in Switzerland, and the novel doesn't cover anything in CERN, but the God particle is this ultimate particle that is the basis of all nature, the basis of light. And it's almost like, the way I interpret it, it's like a particle that creates itself. And there's a double slit presentation that shows light being diffracted through slits and creating a new wave pattern. And they've done tests, and it has to do with observing how the wave changes after it passes through the slit, and they find out that it doesn't really do what it's supposed to be doing. It's almost like a new particle to be created out of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And so this has to do with trying to understand this thing called the God particle, this central particle of all nature. And I know I'm explaining that extremely wrong to anyone who's a scientist out there, but that's my take on that.
Would you say it has consciousness?
Some people believe that. They believe that this is, my interpretation of how this thing works with light for Washington, D.C. ends up being a conscious thing. I'll explain it that way. If you study artificial intelligence, the essence of what consciousness is in computer AI is it has to have a response. In other words, if I tap you on the shoulder and you move, well, then you must be conscious, because you had a response to it. So if you create something that can have a new creation out of the initial tap within, then consciousness has emerged.
Yeah, well, I think quantum physics is opening up so much. And your work, I think, touches on this in such a way that perhaps when we look at such a pattern as we find in Washington, D.C., which is fundamentalists, many fundamentalist conspiratorials look at it and think this is satanic, which is really one of the most pathetic interpretations I've ever seen. Of course, you've never seen such an interpretation, have you?
Well, there's some drawings in the Talisman book that someone would look at, and they may draw that conclusion from that. A pentagram above the White House. Everyone sees the shape. But the pentagram is not necessarily something satanic. It's actually an old symbol for Jerusalem.
Yes.
And that symbol, as a matter of fact, is a pentagram shape to the layout of Jerusalem, the street pattern. And this shape is carried to Rome. And in the Da Vinci Code, not the Da Vinci Code, but the Angels and Demons, where they're running around Rome, really they're running this aspects of this pentagram shape. And the reason that the churches and the obelisk are laid out the way they are in Rome is to duplicate Jerusalem. Rome is taking the place of Jerusalem because they can't travel to the Middle East anymore. It's going to be the new Jerusalem for Europe. And that's what they're rebuilding there. And the same thing's taking place here in the United States. Washington, D.C. is our new Jerusalem. That pentagram above the White House denotes that. That's one possible meaning.
Another aspect there, dealing with the Gnostic view of Jesus as an historical figure. What can you tell us about that?
Well, there's a lot of people who believe that if you see the Bible through the eyes of someone like Joseph Campbell, who sees mythology as the great teaching tool, well, then Jesus is a myth and not a historical figure. But the mythology itself represents the concept of what God is, and that would be a God of sacrifice and to humanity, a God of love. And that's a Gnostic tradition that you can trace to the Greeks. And this whole idea is presented in the novel. Some of the characters talk about this.
Well, there is so much more in your book on philosophical and psychological views. But what is the importance of the brain shape of Washington, D.C.?
Okay. You're getting into the world of Descartes. In the belief, Descartes is the, in my eye, he's the father of the Enlightenment. People in the time of Jefferson and the creation of Washington, D.C., the Enlightenment would have been Descartes and Newton. In Washington, D.C., the pattern that ends up being created is a representation of those two views. You've got the universe, the ordered universe of Newton, and you've got a mind shape that represents the idea that your reality, and this is Descartes' view, your reality is really within you. And because of that, you can determine your own reality and set your own destiny. Your freedom lies within you. It's a freedom of consciousness.
Yes.
And you find those words, I believe, in the Constitution, and when it starts explaining the type of freedom that we really have, it's a freedom to think and a freedom of consciousness. That's the framework of what America is about.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us, Charles. You've opened up many more areas of inquiry about the importance of the design of our nation's capital. And I certainly would like to see more of that spread out in the media to open up some other minds that there's a much larger concept, much larger importance of Washington, D.C. than just the actual symbols that they have there.
Okay.
So when we return, we'll reintroduce you to the transformative music of Telesma, with whom I will be creating a mural next Saturday, November the 14th, at the Wind-Up Space. Thank you for joining us, Charles.
Thank you, Doc.
Hello, advertisers of WCBM, but they should be.
See my special demonstration on the hidden meanings of common symbols together with a performance of the transformative music of Telesma, November the 14th, starting at 8 p.m. at the Wind-Up Space. That's at 12 West North Avenue. One people, one planet, hon, after my presentation on how many common symbols point to the same themes of unity, balance, and a higher state of consciousness, you can watch a new mural created before your very own eyes to the tunes of Telesma. Selections of 40 years of my symbolic art will be on display at the Wind-Up Space from November the 1st through December 31st, together with selections from the rock and roll celebrity photographs of Stuart Zolotaro. Seating is limited, so order your tickets today at brownpapertickets.com. Search One People, One Planet, or call 410-366-7722. That's brownpapertickets.com. Search One People, One Planet, or call 410-366-7722. November the 14th at the Wind-Up Space. If you're a business owner or executive seeking growth yet determined to cut wasteful costs, consider outsourcing your whole marketing department to The Selling Well. The Selling Well offers businesses truly superior marketing services without all the overhead costs associated with employing a full-time marketing executive. Learn more online at thesellingwell.com. That's thesellingwell.com, named after one of our greatest symbols of prosperity, the well. Visit thesellingwell.com or call The Selling Well's managing partner, Plato Hieronymus, at 443-939-1890. TheSellingWell.com.
Hi, this is Janie Hendricks, sister of Jimi Hendrix, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Well, thank you, Janie Hendricks. Can't wait to get together with her in the near future. This is 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Bob Hieronymus. And, you know, you've been hearing us talk about our next guest for several weeks now on 21st Century Radio. They are two members of the transformative Baltimore band called Telesma, and they are joining us tonight to preview our collaborative effort called One People, One Planet, Hun. This Saturday night at the Wind-Up Space on North Avenue. Every musical bumper piece that we played on this show tonight is one of Telesma's, and for the past year, the first sound you hear or heard during our opening every week and our closing were the works of Telesma, especially the heavenly voice of Joanne Juskus, the vocalist and lyricist for Telesma. Joanne Juskus has been a staple of the Baltimore music scene since her debut album was released to critical acclaim in 2001. Named a top 10 favorite by the Washington Post, Joanne has appeared at notable venues including the Meriwether Post Pavilion, New York City's Knitting Factory, and the Bitter End. Boy, I had a great time at the Bitter End when I went up there, twisting the night away. And the Columbia Festival of the Arts. Her second CD released in 2006 explores spiritual as well as musical frontiers, and Joanne also offers voice lessons with an emphasis on freeing the natural voice by way of yoga and breathing techniques. Telesma was co-founded in 2002 by Digaradoo and bamboo mouth harpist Ian Hesford, who also plays the dumbek, junjun, and does throat singing, and Jason Sage, keyboards, percussion, programmer, and lyrics. The two then added musicians Joanne Juskus on vocals, percussion, and, boy, here's a word here, Caratales? Oh, that must be Venezuelan. Chris Mandra, who plays guitar, analog guitar synth, his unique mandrum and vocals. Brian Jones, or Jonesy, who plays six-string MIDI, that's M-I-D-I, and upright basses, theremin and percussion, and Rob Houck on the drum kit, percussion, and electronic drums to complete the lineup. And you better remember all those because we'll give you a quiz when you get there next week. Telesma's unique sound is driven by some of the oldest instruments in the world. The Digaradoo dates back at least 40,000 years. Well, according to certain people on this planet, there's nobody here 40,000 years ago. But, you know, those fundamentalists who say basically the Earth was created about 5,000 years ago, well, they might be wrong, you know. Their combination of an ancient and modern harkens back to the ancient tribal past while reaching a trance-like pulse that can literally alter your state of consciousness. Now, this is one of the longest introductions I've ever done on the planet here. Also joining us is guitarist Chris Mandra, who contributes his unique invention called the mandrum, which he uses to play breakbeats on his body, interacting with a computer program he wrote, creating live improvised music. He has been making electroacoustic music since the early 1980s, integrating orchestral instruments and interactive computer technology in the 1990s, and all while playing in various bands, writing music for theater pieces, indie films, installation art projects, and more. And with that introduction, we're almost out of time. Excuse me, but sometimes it gets kind of weird here on 21st Century Radio. Hey, welcome back to 21st Century Radio, Joanne and Chris.
Hey, great to be back.
Yep, it certainly is great to be back. Last time you joined us, you defined the meaning of your band's name, Telesma, as the Greek root for the word talisman. Did I remember that right?
Yeah, and it also means the unseen.
The unseen. Now, this time I'd like you to explain why you use the AUM symbol of the Hindu tradition in your logo. Tell us more about this word, AUM, and symbol.
Well, actually, we combined the Om symbol from Hinduism with the Om symbol dealing with electricity, electrical resistance, sort of to represent the power of the spirit and also physical power. Telesma is kind of a combination of transcendent experience through music, but also primal beats and, you know, being human, the human side of spirituality, I guess you'd say. So As far as the Om symbol, I have a background in mantra meditation, and so we do a lot of chanting during some of the songs mm-hmm. that we do. So that's definitely an influence, an Eastern influence. And the Om symbol, according to Vedic texts, combines the three different aspects of being, which is creation, maintenance, and transformation or destruction. So the A, the U, and the M combined, and you see it more often written O-M, is a syllable that represents the divine in all its aspects, not just good or evil or what, you know, the things that we tend to think of in our Judeo-Christian culture, but more of a more encompassing aspect of the divine. Every mantra or prayer that's said in Sanskrit begins with Om. It's the syllable that actually represents the divine in the sense that in Sanskrit, supposedly, instead of being a language that, like our language, if you say book, you know, it's not a book. It just represents the word book. But the way it's been described to me, Sanskrit has the words are non-different from what they represent. So especially when you're talking about prayers or names of different aspects of the divine, it's a way to experience orally those forms. Mm-hmm. And then in turn, those mantras are written. So you've seen the shape of the Om or whatever other mantras you're writing. But in our case, the Om symbol represents in a physical, symbolic way that sound vibration of the divine.
Well, your website and album designs are extraordinary, and I noticed that mirror images also employed artfully in all of your design. Is that symbolic of anything particular to you? Let's go to Chris on this. Chris?
It's interesting that you're asking that. I was just talking to Jeremy Opio, who I somewhat jokingly refer to as our Minister of Psychedelia, who does all of that visual work for us. And I was talking to him about, you know, what his take on the whole mirror image thing was. And he told me that he felt that the mirror images were reflections that suggest an inner shamanic world above the four senses, but not seen by them.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess, in other words, he feels like the mirror images represent complex worlds full of dimensional motion, and also says that fourth dimensional art is difficult to create. So this is how we compensate in two dimensions.
Very, very good. Yes, I can understand that. I mean, mirror images, especially in the area of various practices of elevating awareness and consciousness. You know, even in astrology, if you use astrology, you learn sooner or later that when you come across problems with certain types of people, that it's like a mirror, a reflection of yourself that you're dealing with there. It's not just them; it's you as well. So the mirror obviously becomes very important, and also in the area of the work of Dr. Raymond Moody and his use of mirrors to enter other dimensions and bringing other people forth from other dimensions. That's a really interesting research there. Do you want to comment on that?
Well, I mean, it seems to me, you know, it's funny because the work that we do touches on so many different things, and we all have so many varied interests.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me in a world where, in a universe where we talk about like mantra and antimatter, that or yin yang, that we have these, being and not being, or zeros and ones, that we have all of these things that one doesn't exist without the other. Like together they make some sort of whole. That to me the mirror thing makes a lot of sense. It's almost like providing an atmosphere around something that you knew was there anyway, but it's visible in this sense.
Well, Joanne, your visual appearance and the performance, both in your website and your album presentations and in your live performances, seem to be equally important to the sounds that you make. Could you tell us more about a performance by Telesma in a multi-sensory, as a multi-sensory experience?
Yeah. It's funny, Telesma is sort of, I've always thought of Telesma as sort of an organism, and people, we've all sort of plugged into it, not just the musicians that you see on stage, but also dancers that come, audience members. It's a very participatory experience. And so one huge aspect of that is the visual. And so we've worked with different artists, especially Jeremy Opio, who's now doing all our live visual presentations as well as our other artwork and web design. But it's something, it's like this organism that sort of attracts the creative potential in those who want to participate in it. And so on stage, some of us wear, you know, costumes or paint our bodies or whatever, and you'll see at our concerts that people will be painting each other's bodies or painting, you know, artwork like the show that we're going to be doing with you. We love doing stuff like that, so that not just the sense of hearing is satisfied, but also the visual senses and the whole creative impulse that we all share, including the audience. It's crucial, the audience's participation.
How long have you been doing this, dear? Since 2001?
Well, my own music, I've been writing music for, I don't know, probably since the late 80s.
No, I think you were probably doing it when you were 12 years old. Don't you remember that?
Well, that doesn't count.
I just saw a little image of you sitting under a little lamp there, working out something about something. Well, listen, we need to take our first break, our last break, actually, of this particular hour, and award a Telesma CD to one of our listeners here on 21st Century Radio. And when we return, we're going to ask Chris how much of these live performances are improvised. Do you think you can answer that one, Chris?
I'm pretty sure I can answer that one.
Okay, do some research into that,
okay.
And we'll be back in just a little while. Friends, we are talking to two members of Telesma, Chris Mondra and Joanne Juskus, members of the transformative band Telesma. Come hear this ethereal, tribal, otherworldly music and interactive experience this Saturday, the 14th of November. You can also go to www.telesma.com. So join us up the Wind Up Space in Station North Arts, and this is a fundraiser for them, and Entertainment District 12 West North Avenue.
At 6 on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
Next week on 21st Century Radio, have you spent any time thinking about time? How we measure it and why our calendars are organized the way they are? The rhythms of the moon and timekeeping systems around the world. Sunday night at 8, 21st Century Radio, Talk Radio 680 WCBM. Oh, there's that wonderful music again. Yes, indeed. Let's take a look inside the prize library this hour. Yes, there's the CD, Hearing Visions, live by Telesma, courtesy of Telesma. That's www.telesmamusic.com. That's what it says right here. And, of course, you know, you can go back to 21stcenturyradio.com and check that oil, as we used to say. Now, here's the question. If you get the correct answer to this question, then you're going to win that, plus at least a dozen other books and periodicals and a new haircut. Yeah, that's right. A new haircut comes with every library. And you shine your shoes, a new shine shoes. Now, first correct caller is going to win this one. Here it is. Who was our final guest on 21st Century Radio last week? Who was our final guest on 21st Century Radio last week? And if you got that name, if you know who it was and you got it and you get first, then you're going to be our winner, but you got to qualify. And here's how you do that, as I see Laura's head bob up and down. If you know the answer to this hour's quiz question on 21st Century Radio and you have not won from us in the last 60 days, call in now. 410-922-6680. That's 410-WCBM-680. First with the right answer wins. Prizes are available for you to pick up at the WCBM studios in Pikesville after Friday of this week. Winners have 60 days to pick up the prizes and must wait 60 days before winning another prize from 21st Century Radio. Good luck.
Hi, this is Roseanne Cash, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
I have very seldom enjoyed an interview this much.
Oh, really?
Very seldom.
Well, ditto. Well, we haven't heard from Aunt Roseanne for a while, huh? Yes, but indeed. This is still 21st Century Radio, and we're asking you once again to join us at the Wind Up Space in Station North Arts and Entertainment District at 12 West North Avenue. The doors will open on November the 14th at 7 p.m., and the show begins at 8 p.m. with a presentation of also, by the way, I don't think it's been mentioned here tonight, Stuart Zolotaro's photos of some of our favorite people that we used to hang out with, such as Willie Nelson, Jimmy Axolotl, and Fred Pastrzewski. Remember those guys? They were great. And then, of course, there's going to be a presentation on cymbals. I'll be doing that, and followed by the Telesma concert. And while their music lifts us out of our bodies, you can watch us up there. I'll have two assistants, Justin Williams and Carly Hansen, whom I've worked with repeatedly before. They're excellent other artists, two assistants. And we're going to create a live symbolic mural that walks away just as we create it. It's really something. And also, tickets are just a mere $20, and they include a full-color book. Now, the book that we're presenting is a brand new one, just came off the press, dealing with interpretations of the symbols in all the pieces of my work. That will be there from now to about December the 31st. Go to brownpapertickets.com and search One People, One Planet, Hun to order online or call 410. And as a matter of fact, that's all the numbers she put up there. So, well, she was away this weekend, and I guess some of those kind of things happen when that happens. Okay, now, Chris, how much of your live performances are improvised? Tell the truth now.
Well, that's a really interesting question, because the fact is when we started playing together in 2004 with all of us, we would routinely go on stage and play for about 3 hours, and literally like it was all improvised. And that's how we write music as well. I mean, what happens is we write music by playing together and listening and improvising and obsessively recording it all and remembering things that we like. And some people like me will think of something that I really like and just play it over and over again until everybody plays with me. Mm-hmm. And so, for instance, at the Alex Gray show last year, I can honestly and sincerely say that I would say about roughly half an hour of that two-hour show was improvised. But what's interesting to me is I can also tell you that, for instance, the song Imminence, which I heard playing on your station earlier tonight, I was on stage at the 8x10 with the band. We were playing, and Ian leaned over to me and said, start playing something in F sharp. And so I started playing what ended up being the beginning of Imminence. I remember at the end of like a three-hour show at the 13th floor, where I just started playing what was my part of the beginning of Penumbra, and Jonesy and the drummer at the time started playing that boom, 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 boom part. So what's funny is we start from this place of improvisation, and then we find things we like and you know, keep them or exploit them. Like we write music that we think is exciting and that moves us and excites us from this point of improvisation, and then they become songs. Like, one of the improvs from last year's Alex Gray show is a song that we named Shivananda, which we actually had to go back and then learn. It's very weird to learn an improv, but it's something we do. So I would say, as a routine matter, of course, we try to make at least 25% of the current shows that we play improvised. It doesn't always happen. If it's a short show, like we're playing for an hour or something, we may just blast through the songs that are, you know, up-tempo and that are really a lot of fun to play.
It is nice, others aren't fun to play, but yeah.
So I would say at least a quarter of a longer show is improvised. And it's just because we have so many songs now that more isn't.
Joanne, you were about ready to say something.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like at the show on next Saturday with you, it's really fun for us when we have artists on the stage to improvise because we're sort of feeding off each other. We're feeding off, of course, the energy of the audience, but then the artists who are painting inspire us, and then in turn, you know, they're listening, you'll be listening to us, and so it's sort of a play with art and music together, and mm-hmm. those shows are always exciting.
Yeah.
And Egyptian Sun, which you play on your show regularly, I think, right?
It has opened our show for the last several months.
That song is special to me because when I first saw Ian and Jason play, I said, you know, if you ever need a vocalist, I would love to sing with you. And it's been great fun singing with this amazing band, so rhythmic, so melodic, so, you know, full of energy. And so they said, sure, you know, come to the 8x10, we're doing a gig. So I showed up at the gig, and they started playing this rhythm, and I just started off the top of my head singing, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, and Chris was playing his stuff, and it just all happened. It was just a song, and a lot of our songs are like that. They just, and I don't really, we don't talk about it, we don't even really look at each other. It's we are all doing what we do, and we're listening to one another and sort of feeling our way through it. And it's a wonderfully fun, spontaneous way to make music.
It sure is. And back in the old days when I used to sing up in the village, we would do improvs. I did one improv of 26 minutes on this one particular song. It was the best song I've ever done in my life. And, of course, we could never repeat it.
Well, that's the thing. That's why we have to record it because, maybe there's the magic of just making it in the moment and you know, losing it like those Buddhists who do the chalk drawings and then wipe them away. Yeah. But we like to be able to capture them. So would I.
I wish I could have done that.
Yeah.
But nobody recorded anything back in those days. But you can do it now, though.
Well, maybe it's still swirling around in the ether and it'll manifest.
Yeah, there was one called Little Laura Bell that I sang for 26 minutes. I'd like to remember that one.
Mm.
Now, Joanne, I would imagine that as a vocalist, the improvisational segments are challenging. How do you improvise vocalizations in a live setting?
There's a whole spirit thing going on with, you know, the energy from the audience, hearing what they're playing. I rarely will start off an improvisation. I'll hear what they're doing, and I'll take my cues most of the time from Chris because he's the melodic instrument. I mean, there's the bass, too. So between Chris and Jonesy on bass, I'll know what key I'm to sing in. But I just feel it, and I think that's what everybody does. For me, vocally, I don't usually make up words right on the spot. I've written a lot of songs with a lot of words, and I don't know, I feel like at this point in my life, and with Telesma in particular, it's not like we have a message or a belief or anything that we're trying to communicate. I mean, some people call us a spiritual band or whatever, but that's the last thing that I want to do is to, you know, tell anybody what to think or believe or whatever, but and I find a great freedom in not using lyrics, but I do sometimes we have lyrics, and sometimes I'll turn to mantras, which are wonderfully rhythmic as well. So it's a time to play, you know. It's for me it's all about the sound and the feeling.
Do we have time to play a few cuts here and ask a little few questions? Yes, we do. My boss tells me we can do that. Let's play a little clip of the song Ohm, O-H-M or O-M, the title track of their 2007 album. Could you do that?
Oh.
Hey, which of you wants to tell us what's behind that piece?
Well, I think we'll both contribute something to telling you about it. I think we called the album O H in parentheses M because and we already touched on this a bit, but we felt that it really typified the intersection that we feel for the spiritual and the intellectual, and as a result, we wanted to have a piece that allowed us to do something that was very rhythmically free and had a wide sort of sound palette, dealt more with like masses of sound and less with rhythm. It's fairly ambient in a way. We feel like what we're doing is allowing people to go on a journey with us, and sometimes getting in and out of the journey is like any journey, you know, if it's mystical or spiritual or shamanistic or even drug induced, that you enter in a way and you exit in a way and you're there for a while. And I think that we were trying to exploit the sound palette that we have and the fact that we are very comfortable with the voice. Like that tune, we get to the second part of this thing, and then it's basically this toning, which is this thing that we do, which we try to do at the beginning of every show, where we basically hold hands, and generally we start singing together with the note E as the basis for whatever we're doing, and we move from there. And it's all listening, and it's us listening to each other and responding to each other, and it allows us to sort of get in touch with ourselves. And it's funny, because that's, you know, that part, like that tune at the end of the album, has all these crazy electronic sounds and Joanne's unbelievably beautiful voice. And then it sort of crossfades into what we basically do at the beginning of every show. And something, and one last thing that I think is really cool about this is that that album is made in such a way that when you hear the singing at the end of it fade out, if you have the album on repeat, the beginning of Egyptian Sun is that toning track at the end of Om backwards. So we feel like it ties everything together. Joanne, I don't know what do you think?
Well, I was just going to talk about how we did it, because I remember that was, I think, the last thing that we recorded, at least for me, when we recorded that album. I remember going in on the very last day, it was like a Sunday afternoon or something, and
yeah,
all of the guys had gone in, I think, the day before and recorded their parts, and they wanted to have, you know, like modern electronic sounds and just sort of drone kinds of sounds, and it sounded very mystical and sort of spacey. And I hadn't heard it. I had no preconceived notion about what I was going to do, but they just recorded me singing to it. And so I just went with this, like Chris was describing, going on a journey. I just went along for the ride, and whatever came through me. And a lot of it is ancient Sanskrit mantras. And it just felt right to have that intersection of the ancient sounds with these more modern, futuristic, spacey kinds of sounds. And
right there, we're just about out of time. Joanne, thank you very much,
sure,
both of you, for joining us here on 21st Century Radio. And, of course, it is November the 14th, 7 p.m. The doors are open, 8 p.m. The presentation starts at 12 West North Avenue, and we got a telephone number here called 410-366-7722. 410-366-7722. Boy, thank you, folks, Chris and Joanne, for joining us.
Thank you, Doctor.
Most powerful names in talk.
Talk Radio 680, WCBM Baltimore, and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio, I'm Sal Giangrasso.